Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a brief discussion of compelling legal issues and practical insights. Please note that the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be, nor should it be construed as legal advice. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. Please enjoy the program.
Welcome back, everybody. This is another episode of Safety Perspectives from Region 6. I'm John Surma, one of your co-hosts. I am a shareholder in the Houston office of Ogletree Deacons, and I've got my good friend and podcasting partner, Frank D. Davis, a shareholder in our Dallas office, with me today. How you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good, John. It's good to see you again. Happy midweek. Making it through this one so far so good, I guess, given that we got a surprise delivery, not so much of a surprise delivery last week with this final walk-around rule that OSHA published.
Speaking of the walk-around rule, you and I did a webinar as part of our OSHA Primer series, and your webinar was on the rulemaking process. And one of the rules that we spoke about was the walk-around rule. And then lo and behold, what happens the very next day?
Yeah, the very next day. Well, we talked about that during the webinar, right? Because we'd gotten notice that we expected the rule to be published any day. And it took about 10 days from when we received first notice, I think, until it actually finally came out. I think that's the right count. We had the advance notification, but then it comes out on a Friday, like so many of these things seem to.
All joking aside, I know that you also dove into this rule. And so I thought it would be helpful, seeing as I'm getting a ton of client inquiries, for you and I to have a conversation and talk to our audience about, you know, kind of what this walk around rule is, what the history of it was, you know, some challenges it may pose to employers, and just kind of, you know, big picture overall, you know, some thoughts that they might want to have in mind if OSHA shows up and wants to do something with this rule. So I thought that would be kind of a good topic for this podcast. And if you're game for it, let's go through it. Let's start off with the history of the walk-around rule. And back in 2013, when this standard interpretation was issued that allowed a worker or workers at a place that did not have a collective bargaining agreement, a non-union workplace, to designate a person affiliated with a union to act on their behalf during a walk-around, that standard interpretation, as I recollect, was limited to union representatives, and it didn't include kind of the wide array of third parties that we're now looking at. Is that a fair characterization of that standard interpretation?
I think that the focus was on allowing workers in a non-union facility to select a union official to act as the employee representative. My understanding that even back then, it was up to the compliance officer to determine whether there was good cause and whether it was reasonably necessary to include a union representative to accompany in a non-union environment. That's what that letter of interpretation said, is that that workers in a non-union facility, subject to approval by the compliance officer to determine whether they were helpful or not, could include a union representative to act on their behalf. And then, as you know, in 2015, OSHA actually sort of codified it into their inspection criteria by incorporating that letter of interpretation into their field operation manual. That's when we saw the lawsuit filed that ultimately resulted in the rejection of OSHA's authority to expand the right or who they could include when the Northern District of Texas, the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Texas, said they didn't have authority to do that unless they went through the rulemaking process. And that's what we see that OSHA's done here, is they've tried to get through the rulemaking process now to fully codify their plan to include third parties that is expanded beyond union representatives. But whenever you read the 149 pages of their justification for the rule, of OSHA's justification for the rule. It is replete with representations by various unions throughout the country explaining why it's so important for unions to be able to have access to the workplace.
During that frame of time, did you ever have an inspection where a union representative was brought into a workplace that wasn't covered by a collective bargaining agreement?
I did have opportunities to tell them no, they can't bring in their union representative doing an inspection. And the response was, well, if you won't let them in, we may have to get a warrant. And fortunately, had clients that were willing to go that way and said, fine, go get your warrant. And they never did. They just conducted the inspection without the union representative being present. And whenever you read the preamble or the analysis of all the comments to the current walk-around rule, you'll see that there were a lot of instances where unions were involved in inspections, but they were not authorized to enter a facility during an inspection. And they weren't authorized to participate in interviews with employees during an inspection on company property, I should say, on company property. These stories that they tell in the preamble is that there is union involvement, there has been union involvement, but that union involvement was off-site, wasn't on company property. And interestingly, OSHA says, well, this is what justifies us including union representatives on the walk around and actually bringing union representatives into the facility, is that we've demonstrated that unions are helpful in our inspections. But I know our listeners have heard me say repeatedly that OSHA is an executive branch agency. And so as an executive branch agency, their actions are directed from the President of the United States. And so when you have a President of the United States that is vowing to be the most union-friendly president in history, I guess the results of a workplace rule like this come as no surprise to anybody who's paying attention.
The rule itself, can you kind of explain to our audience, and if you want to read it to them, if you want to, you know, kind of parse it out section by section or whatever you want to do, I don't think it really matters to our audience, but can you kind of explain to them what this rule looks like now that it's been significantly expanded to go beyond union representatives into a non-union workforce?
I think that's not a problem. So the old rule had some similarities, right? And it said that a compliance safety and health officer, what we call COSHOs, for good cause, when they have established good cause, may include a third party who is not an employee of the employer. They talk about industrial hygienist or safety engineer in the original rule before it was revised. They can, when good cause shows that it's reasonably necessary to conduct an effective and thorough inspection of the workplace. What they've done here is OSHA's removed the industrial hygienist or safety engineer example, such as, and they've expanded it now to include a larger population. And the new language in this rule says, including but not limited to their relevant knowledge, skills, experience with hazards or conditions in the workplace or similar workplaces, or language or communication skills. So you see that it's beyond somebody with technical knowledge, an industrial hygienist being somebody who can evaluate health hazards in the workplace that for some reason OSHA might not have the expertise to identify, or a safety engineer who might be able to identify safety hazards in the workplace that OSHA for some reason is not able to identify. They've expanded it now to be a much more subjective range of subjects of required knowledge, relevant knowledge. Right? Relevant knowledge is a pretty subjective standard. You know, what is relevant knowledge with regard to hazards or conditions in the workplace? What's relevant to me is, you know, probably different than OSHA's definition of what's relevant, or even communication skills. What kind of communication skills are we talking about? Well, that's not defined. It's just not defined in the standard. And whenever we're talking about this, we go back and we look at other parts of it, right? It says, well, OSHA defines it by saying, well, we don't have to define what these characteristics are because it's up to the compliance officer to determine whether good cause has been shown. And it's up to the compliance officer to determine whether it's reasonably necessary to conduct an effective and thorough physical inspection. You know, one of the arguments, and then I'll let you direct me through a question. One of the arguments that we made when we were submitting comments is all that taken together is very subjective. It's very vague. It doesn't give us a good indication of who would be admitted, one, and two, it doesn't give a good objective criteria or a rubric as a quantifiable rubric as OSHA references in the preamble to the rule to help us understand what thought process the compliance officer is going to go through. But you and I both know that even simple things, there's inconsistency in enforcement across the nation, and OSHA has done nothing to reconcile that inconsistency through this rule or through their analysis in the preamble.
Well, I would go even more granular than that from the standpoint of inconsistency. I mean, even within area offices, depending upon which COSHO you're working with, application of, you know, whether it's kind of the standard 1910, 1926 standards, or, you know, how inspections are conducted or what have you. I mean, there's a fair amount. I mean, there's patterns of similarity, but there's a fair amount of inconsistency even at that level. So then when you place this decision squarely in the judgment of the compliance officer, it's going to be all over the board, would be my expectation and my prediction. I assume that's yours as well.
It is. You know, even in simple matters, and I'm going to be very vague about how I explain this because I don't want to call out any particular compliance officer or area office, but within the last year, within the last 6 weeks, I've had an instance where I was at an inspection, and on a simple issue, right? OSHA has been audio recording in Region 6, as we announced, for about 18 months, right? And we all sort of know what to expect. OSHA pulls out their tape recorder and they say they're going to tape record the interview. And we say, okay, well, I've got my tape recorder. We're going to tape record the interview too. Everybody says, okay. And everybody keeps their own recording until there's a contest and OSHA has to give us their recording. You know, within the last 6 weeks, I was at an inspection where the compliance officer pulled out their tape recorder and said, okay, I'm going to tape this manager interview. And I said, okie dokie, I'm going to make a recording of it as well. And the compliance officer said, well, you can't do that. And I said, well, if you're going to record, I'm entitled to record as well. And, you know, that's what OSHA's counsel for Region 6 has said. And that seems like an obvious position to take. It seems like it's been well disseminated and that everybody in Region 6 should understand that expectation. But this compliance officer actually checked with their area director, who said, well, the only way that he can record is if they also provide us a copy of the recording, which isn't the standard. I mean, that's not how OSHA's enforced it. So it's a very sophomoric example, but that's an easy one not to get wrong, and they got it wrong. And so you look at a bigger issue like letting a stranger into your facility that has no connection to your facility whatsoever. How can you be assured of any type of consistency in the way this rule is applied?
The new rule says, and, you know, we'll put the dot, 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 or period, 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 ellipses, whatever you want to say, by a third party is reasonably necessary to the conduct of an effective and thorough physical inspection of the workplace. And then it's the parenthetical, including but not limited to, because of their relevant knowledge, et cetera. Is it your interpretation and your understanding that this is limited to the physical walkthrough of the workplace, or will this cover the entirety of the inspection?
The plain language reading to me is that it's the physical inspection of the workplace, that it's the walk around portion. Because of the inconsistent enforcement that I anticipate to come from this, I expect that compliance officers will try to involve union organizers and community organizers in employee and management interviews. It wouldn't surprise me to see that come up. I'm prepared to object to that, that's outside the scope of the rule. But I won't be surprised the first time I hear in the next, it goes into effect 60 days from Friday or sometime in that range. I wouldn't be surprised on the 61st day to have that question come up. Hey, do I have to let a union organizer in with my manager interview from one of our clients? I think I know how I'll answer that question.
And we'll stay tuned to see how that shakes up. On that point, Frank, what are the employer's options if faced with a compliance officer who wants to bring in some third party? And I think, my personal perspective is if we have a third party who is, kind of in that scientific expertise type area, engineering expertise, what have you, technical expertise maybe is the best term for it, that's probably going to be a little bit harder to object to because that's kind of been the rule all along. What is your expectation in terms of what an employer can do if somebody is brought in who is a community organizer, is a environmental person, is, some community member who's just coming in to, translate for the one person who speaks, some language that OSHA doesn't have the ability to communicate directly with? What options does an employer really have in those circumstances?
Well, let me start with this, that one of you read the preamble, it doesn't matter if OSHA has access to or could possibly understand the language, even if it's a common language like Spanish in the United States, if it's a non-Spanish speaking in COSHO, or if the COSHO is unfamiliar with the particular version of the Spanish spoken or the culture that's associated with the language spoken, then there's still under the analysis here for the preamble, then the COSHO still has the ability to say, I think I'm going to need this union organizer or this community organizer to come in and help with the subtleties of the communication, even in that situation. So it doesn't have to be a unique language that we may not be familiar with or may not have a lot of resources. So I'd say that's not a strong argument. I would say it's a strong argument, but the preamble would beg otherwise. But whenever I was looking at these rules, I was looking for, one of the things I was looking at is how does an employer protect its workplace from somebody coming in wanting to steal trade secrets. I'll just say it straight out. And that's dealt with, interestingly, on page 45 of the preamble, where it talks about protection of trade secrets or other confidential business information. Because, people that were making comments were saying, how do we ensure that we're protecting those things? And OSHA came out and pretty aggressively said, look, the existing regulations expressly afford employers the right to identify areas in the workplace that contain or might reveal a trade secret. And the employer can request in any of those areas that the authorized employee representative be an employee, not a third party, to enter that area, which made me start thinking, well, how is my entire operation not a trade secret? Or how is my entire operation, how has it not contained confidential business information? I generally, whenever I'm producing documents to OSHA, treat everything as confidential business information, unless it's a government form we're required to fill out. So I went
here. Absolutely.
Right. So I went to look at how OSHA defines trade secrets, and they describe them as processes, operations, style of work or apparatus, or the identity, confidential statistical data, amount or source of any income, profits, losses, or expenditures of any person, firm, partnership, corporation, or association. It's super broad. It's a super broad definition, and it's in the Field Operation Manual under Chapter 13, Section 7, subparagraph E, and they reference it in the preamble. So to me, that covers pretty much all work I ever walk in on. And so there may be a basis to limit third-party access based on trade secrets and confidential business information. And so, you know, when we talk about ways to limit access, to me, that limits access at the shop door.
Yeah, that definition is super, super broad. And, you know, I thank you for bringing that definition to my attention. I had kind of a global or very broad view of what I considered confidential information, but I did not consider it to be quite that broad. And so I'm going to have to tape that on the inside of my notebook and take that to every inspection and read it every inspection and remind myself that this is what the definition that OSHA promulgates of confidential information is, and basically hold them to that. Other than designating essentially the workplace as being full of confidential information, and therefore the third party cannot enter that area, what other options can you think of, or do you think employers have to resort to keep somebody who's a third party out of the workplace if they feel that that third party is not appropriately in their workplace?
Right. Or if they feel like the compliance officer hasn't done a good job of explaining why they think that person's reasonably necessary or what good cause exists.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, look, I think we've touched on this in prior podcasts, but the reality is, like every other employer in the country, OSHA has undergone an enormous amount of turnover. And so you have a lot of compliance officers out there who are really, really new and, you know, aren't all that terribly comfortable in the role in the first place just because of their newness to the role. And then they certainly don't have an extraordinarily high degree of familiarity with, you know, the document you're referring to with the definition of confidential business information is the field operations manual, the FOM. And so, you know, there's a lot of times where, you know, they don't have the ability, and it's not like an intellectual capacity thing. It's just the newness to the job and the lack of familiarity with the rule book, where they have to reach out to their boss and basically get an explanation. And then, you know, they kind of give you a truncated version of the boss's answer back. And they really aren't able to justify all that terribly well what the justification is. So yeah, absolutely. I can see plenty of instances where they're going to struggle with that.
And so I think that's an important question before an employer makes a decision about whether to authorize a third party to enter is, well, is the good cause question and the reasonable why is it reasonably necessary, right? But, and what I envision happening is a lot of compliance officers telling me they don't have to give me that answer. But I think whatever the response is, I think is a better way to phrase it. And once the compliance officer gives that answer, it would be a good response to document well and try to get exact what the compliance officer said about the justification, the good cause, and the reasonably necessary justification for the entrance. Because the entire preamble is, to me, a circular argument about the way employer rights are protected is because the compliance officer must establish good cause and that it's reasonably necessary. It doesn't define good cause, doesn't define reasonably necessary. It's a very ambiguous term, very subjective analysis. And OSHA, by the way, rejected our arguments that it was a subjective analysis. And again, reverted back to the circular argument. Well, this is the way it's always been. There's no need to change the good cause or reasonably necessary parameters or to further define them, because it's upon the compliance officer to determine what is good cause and what is reasonably necessary. Very circular argument. It doesn't ever give an answer. But I think it's important. It would be important to me as an employer to ask that question. Well, why do you think there's good cause to have this third party come in, and why is it reasonably necessary to the inspection? And then make a good record of that. I'd almost do it like a deposition. Okay, here's what I understood you to say or the basis for good cause. Is there anything you'd like to add to that? Here's what I understood you to say are the justifications for reasonably necessary. Is there anything else you'd like to add to that? And then once you pin down the compliance officer on that analysis, assuming they'll give you a thoughtful analysis, I suspect many won't, then that's the time to make the decision about whether to allow entry.
And if you refuse to allow entry, what's that ultimately, what path are we ultimately heading down at that point?
Yeah, well, it's the same path as before. The employers always have the right to deny entry, but if an employer denies entry, then OSHA's has the right to go and seek a warrant. To OSHA's credit in the preamble, they recognize that right of an employer to demand a warrant. And they even go as far as to say, OSHA even goes as far as to say, and we're not going to hold it against an employer who demands a warrant in this situation. I'll give OSHA some praise where I think it's due. I think that is the right position for OSHA to take. Say, sure, you can deny entry and we're not going to hold it against you to require us to get a warrant.
One last question for you, Frank. There was an NFIB challenge to the rule that the Northern District ruled on back in 2017. Are you anticipating that there's going to be litigation filed relative to this rule?
I can't imagine how there won't be. There have been other challenges recently that have come up regarding Biden-era regulations and trying to expand rights that different executive branch agencies have. I'm trying to be selective here in my words, that have been rejected through legal action. I expect this will be one that's challenged. The standard for challenge is under Chevron. It's a little bit higher bar than maybe some of the other regulations that have recently been objected. I'm sorry, rejected. But I can't imagine that someone doesn't file a pre-enforcement challenge to this rule. I have to think that's coming.
And they've got a little time to actually get that on file before this becomes effective. So I guess we'll have to come back and revisit the issue in early June to see if anybody has actually pulled the trigger on some litigation.
Yeah, well, I think there'll be more discussions about this rule to be had. I mean, we didn't even talk about the overlap with the National Labor Relations Act. And if we don't do it, if you and I don't do it, I suspect other of our law partners will do it.
Well, Frank, we've held our audience a little longer than we would normally hold them, but this is a pretty important topic. As always, it's been a pleasure. It's good to get back in the podcasting mode with you, and hope you have a great end to your week.
Yeah, you too. I'll talk to you again soon, John.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.